All right, let's go ahead and get started. So my topic this afternoon, I'm going to be talking a bit about the role of errors in Austrian business cycle theory and some consequences of the role of errors when we start looking at things like fiscal stimulus. Okay. A lot of, actually, the ideas for this lecture come from Dr. Holzman, who wrote a paper several years ago called Toward a General Theory of Error Cycles. I very much liked the paper when I read it in 2004, I think it was. But it ends up, if you read that paper and then listen to my lecture, I'm going to end up disagreeing with a lot of the points he makes, but that's okay. Right? He's not here to defend himself, so I'll go ahead and do that. All right. Yeah, I'm very careful to only disagree with Dr. Holzman when he's not in the room. Okay. So the first point I want to make is just that for us to have any understanding of business cycles at all, we have to accept that errors have to be part of the story. Okay, so to make that point, I've thrown up here, this is the S&P Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index. And it's an index that tracks housing prices in, appropriately enough, 20 cities. And here I captured much of what we would call the housing bubble, right, in this time period. Right, there's the bubble. Here we have the period of the crisis, and then, of course, the collapse. Now, just to highlight that error has to be part of the story, I want to focus on this point right here, the crisis. Now, I think any time we start graphing things, regardless what it is, we need to be a little bit nervous, because it's very easy, I think, for us to separate graphs of whatever from the actual real phenomenon that's happening. All right, so, okay, here's some line on a graph, and it goes up, then it goes down. Right. Okay, what's actually going on? Right. This is, in a sense, trying to get a sense of what average house prices are doing. But a price, really, is just two people are exchanging this house and agreed on some price for that house. So what's really happening here, right, as the bubble goes on, right, people are finding higher and higher prices agreeable. And so, yes, I'll go ahead and buy this house for significantly more. In the end, right here, more than twice as much I'm willing to pay for the house as at this point. Right? So we become much more willing to pay for this house until we hit this point, and then we become much less willing to buy this house at a very high price. So that's the real phenomenon that's going on. Right? And I'd submit that makes explaining this point and this price very difficult, right? Unless we assume some kind of error is happening. Right? Okay. Now, to really lay this out, what I'm first attacking is this idea of perfect foresight. Perfect foresight should be a rather obviously stupid assumption, right? Because all perfect foresight means is that I can perfectly foresee the future. Right? I do, in fact, have a magical crystal ball that will tell me exactly how everything is going to play out. Right? I'd suggest that's very problematic when we look at this graph. Because right? What that's telling us is that there are people who are willing to pay a significantly high price for houses at this point in time, right around early 2006, right, knowing that that price of that house is going to absolutely collapse over the course of the next 2 years. Right? I'd suggest people generally don't act that way. Right? We don't buy assets that we tend to think of as investments, expecting them to lose a significant amount of their value over the next 2 years. It's just not what we do. So it must be that the buyers at this point, at least the grand majority of them, had no clue that things were going to collapse in the future. They, in fact, didn't have perfect foresight. Okay, so perfect foresight is probably out. And I feel like the argument I just made should have been unnecessary. All right? If I think about myself, I was wrong a couple times, right? Which proves I don't have perfect foresight. Both times, I didn't have perfect foresight. And I would guess you probably have at least once as well. So we obviously don't have perfect foresight, but we can also apply this in the case of a business cycle. And see, obviously, people do not have perfect foresight. So that's out. Now, another possibility that is a very common assumption in mainstream views of business cycles is what we call rational expectations. The view of rational expectations suggests that, in effect, our expectations are right on average, But sometimes weird things come along that we just can't foresee. Because there's a lot of randomness that goes on. Right? So the rational expectations view would suggest that right around this point in time, or shortly thereafter, some random thing happened that drove down the price of housing. But it was something that we couldn't possibly predict. Right? It's not something that would happen on average. It's just something very unusual that came along and did it. Now, to a certain degree, I have a lot of sympathy for this view. I don't know. It might just be that I like to believe in rationality or something. Or it might be that my graduate professors have had an influence on me, so I feel very sympathetic toward an assumption they'll often make. So to a certain degree, okay, maybe this is true. It does suggest, if expectations are right on average, that suggests things like learning happen. Okay, right. So I might make mistakes, but I learn from them so that on average I'm not totally wrong all the time. Right. So okay, I'm feeling okay about that, but it starts to feel very unsatisfying to me when I look at the size of this collapse. Okay. Right now, I can see lots of little changes I may not be able to foresee. Sure, right, on average, I could get those things wrong. But a huge collapse, you would think we would be able to see something coming. We should be able to have some sense that this thing is coming, but the whole argument about the purchase that happened in the crisis is that it only really makes sense if we don't see this coming. Okay. I guess in a sense, what I find very unsatisfying at rational expectations, if you really take it to its full extent, it implies a real business cycle theory, which is one of what I think are really the two major business cycle theories right now that is very common. The real business cycle theory suggests that all fluctuations in the economy, at least on a large scale, are really just random and unpredictable. Right. So more or less, the real business cycle theory folks would say, well, yeah, okay, GDP went up. Well, it just happened. Right. Oh, there was a housing collapse. Well, that just happened. Right. Kept collapsing. Well, it just happened again. Kept collapsing. Well, it just happened again. Yeah. Kept collapsing. Well, we've had very bad luck. Right? Right. Sometimes when you go to Vegas, you do actually lose several dice rolls in a row, and that's just what happened all the way from early 2006 to, 2009 or so. And this feels very unsatisfying. I can be very sympathetic with the real business cycle folks, say, if I look at changes like this. Relatively small, relatively short. Okay, maybe this was something weird happened that nobody could see coming. But when we have these huge collapses, I start to kind of think about this type of forecasting kind of like I feel about meteorology. So maybe the weatherman said, well, we might have a chance of showers today at 3 o'clock. It ends up it happened at 4. Okay, fine. Right, and that's the kind of thing. There's enough randomness in the atmosphere. You couldn't get that exactly right. But on the other hand, if he totally doesn't see a hurricane coming, I feel like there are problems with my meteorologist. Right? Or if the hurricane hits and he says, well, it'll clear up by this afternoon. Right? There are serious problems here. Right? And that's kind of the way that I feel about trying to apply real business cycle theory to these very serious collapses that do actually happen in the economy. I feel like there must be something else going on. Okay. Right, so what I would suggest is that what we actually have happening is that there's what Professor Holzman calls a cluster of errors that goes on during the business cycle, where entrepreneurs are all making the same kinds of errors at the same time, and then when the crisis hits, right after this peak, these errors get revealed. We realize that these investments that we thought were going to pay off aren't going to pay off. Now, exactly how they get revealed, well, that can vary by the circumstance. Right? In this case of the housing crisis, I would really point to, say, what interest rates did, in that during the bubble, interest rates were extremely low, were exceptionally low, especially on adjustable rate mortgages. That draws people into investing in housing, especially using adjustable rate mortgages. And then right around, should not be shocking, right around this time, interest rates rise substantially. That also happens to be the timing right around when a lot of adjustable rate mortgages have their rates adjust. So now we find out I can't afford this home that I thought I could afford. Because it ends up it's far more expensive for me to live there. So I made this error. I thought interest rates were going to be very, very low for a very long time, and I was wrong. And lots of other people were drawn into this error as well. So this suggests, right, that our errors, right, we don't have perfect foresight, errors do exist, right, and we don't even have rational expectations. Right? Rational expectations would suggest that our errors are in no way predictable. They're not connected with each other at all. Instead, we get these clusters of errors that do actually happen. And one point I'll make here is this isn't just true in Austrian business cycle theory. It's certainly true in Austrian business cycle theory. We have clusters of errors. But even using things like aggregate supply and aggregate demand, you get in a very standard mainstream course. Robert Lucas was an economist. I very much like his name. His last name is my first name. He's named very well and managed to have the foresight to be named several generations before I had my first name. And he suggested that we can only explain business cycles in this type of aggregate supply, aggregate demand framework if we have things happening that are unforeseeable. There has to be some kind of error there, something we cannot foresee. The way that the world approached his statement was then going through a business cycle theory. So took a good insight and steered the wrong direction. That's often the way theory works. Let's focus on these clusters of errors, though. Okay, how might we explain them? This is the point where I'm disagreeing with Dr. Holzman. In his paper, Dr. Holzman suggests you don't try to explain error. Right? Error is not something we necessarily can explain. It could be wrong for lots of possible reasons. But I'll give some hypotheses. So, sources of error. Why is it that it seems like we do have these clusters of errors that show up time and time again? Right, in the late 1990s, we had errors regarding, say, how we viewed these various internet companies. We viewed them far more favorably than we should have. Housing was another one. Who knows what it is right now? Right, okay. Well, there's something out there. The conditions are right for a bubble to be starting somewhere. So why is it that these errors happen? Well, we can make a few observations. One is that foresight is really just difficult. And this seems true. And, you know, I can perhaps foresee very simple things, like if I hold this pen out here and I let go of it, it's going to fall to the floor. I can foresee that relatively easily. But at the same time, I know that economic phenomena are far more complex. Right? It's the result of millions of people interacting in markets, right? And not only interacting in markets, but interacting in lots of different markets that are connected to each other. Right? So I think it's much more akin, if I'm trying to predict what's happening in the marketplace, to try to predict what order you all are going to leave through the door. Right? Here, it's not even millions of people, right? It's dozens at best, right? Trying to walk out this door in a particular order, and I'm trying to predict what order you're going to go in. So the reality is that foresight is going to be very difficult. I can make some guess, maybe those close to the door are going to walk out a little bit faster. Right? But knowing them, they might be more inclined to actually come up and ask me questions afterwards. So, okay, maybe that'll be wrong. Right? So even there, something as simple as closer to the door means you walk out faster, I might be wrong. Okay. And now that I've said it, they might try to prove me wrong. That's the funny thing about humans, right? As soon as you tell them you're studying them, they often change their behavior. We don't like it. Okay, so foresight is difficult. That's true. I'd suggest this isn't a great explanation for business cycles, though. Right? It's true. But why is it that foresight is difficult would lead us all to be extremely optimistic about housing? Shouldn't we have some of us be extremely pessimistic about housing at the same time? Right? There's a reason that we're all making not just errors. Right? Foresight being difficult will explain errors, sure. But we're all making the same kinds of errors. So what's going on for that? Well, here there are a couple different explanations that get to that detail. I really like this argument. It's not the way that I end up going. Walter Block suggests, among others, that during the business cycle, the low interest rates are really just bribes to make a particular type of error. And so when we make interest rates exceptionally low, especially mortgage interest rates, we're effectively bribing people to go out and to buy houses. Let me move that over a little bit. Okay, sounds fair enough. This is reasonable. I'm not going to argue against that at all. This makes sense. Another view that I'm significantly more critical of has been presented by, among others, Curley and Empster wrote a paper. And they suggest that there's a difference here between private incentives and social incentives. So we might observe, if I can find that, there we go. Right, so we'd imagine, say, investing in housing at, say, this point right here. The question is, does it make sense to buy a house at this point in time? Right. Now, we know from a mass perspective, those of us that understand Austrian business cycle theory, is if we all hop in, we're going to drive the price of housing up, creating this bubble that eventually is going to have to collapse. Right. It's amazing. Austrian business cycle theory should be very simple, right, because it can be boiled down to that bubbles pop. I'm trying to teach my now 1.5-year-old this. Right? Bubbles pop. Right? This should not be shocking. Right? So, from this point, right, should we all hop into the market and create this bubble that we know is going to collapse? Now, we know socially this is a bad thing. Right? It would actually be better for us not to invest in the bubble. But at the same time, it can be very tempting to say, well, if I'm good, if I'm really good, I can hop in now, hop out somewhere around the crisis point, right? And sure, I'm part of the problem because I'm buying into this bubble, but at the same time, I can make a lot of money in the process. Right? So privately, I have this incentive to do something that socially is not necessarily a very good thing to do. Okay. Right? And on the face of it, this sounds pretty good. I have problems with it that I think will become more clear if you come to my lecture tomorrow. Tricky there, okay. Right. So come tomorrow and I think you'll get a sense of what my problem is. I'm not going to be explicit about it there either. Don't want to be unfair to the people that only come to that lecture. All right. But I'd suggest this actually isn't a great explanation for a few reasons. One that I'll hint at is that even if we do know Austrian business cycle theory, one of the things we should know about it is that we can't quite precisely time when the bust is going to happen. Right, now, we can do things like looking at when skyscrapers are built, and that gives us a hint that we're approaching it. Right? Dr. Thorne has already given that talk, right? Okay, good, I timed it right. Right. So we can do things like this and get a sense that we're heading toward the crisis, but getting the timing just right is very difficult. And at the same time, I think that it's true that understanding Austrian business cycle theory doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great investor in general. Here, I hope that that's true. Just from my own experience, and that I was very lucky when I first started investing in seventh grade, because I wanted to go to law school before I was actually converted to a more honest line of work. I wanted to go to law school, and I'm going to have to pay for law school. Right, so I'm going to start investing. Right, and the first stock that I bought, it was called AirTouch Communications. It was a relatively early cell phone company. Got bought out by Vodafone, which is now a partner in Verizon. And it did very well. It doubled in a year. I thought, oh, yeah. Now eighth grade me, best investor ever. Right. But it ends up in the mid to late 90s. It was actually relatively easy to double your money in the stock market, especially investing in cell phone companies. Right. So then I went to college, and I invested, well, for a college student, a significant amount of money in an account. In that account, I now have $1.19. It ends up when I was in college, the best predictor that a company would go bankrupt was that I'd buy them a couple months beforehand. Yeah, okay. So I'm hoping that I can understand Austrian business cycle theory and still be a lousy investor. Right? You can understand the theory, but it doesn't guarantee you'll get the timing right. Okay. I hope. Okay. All right. Right. So that's one problem. If we understand the theory, we still might not get the timing right. I think there is a better explanation, though. This is one that I originally found introduced by a pair of economists, Baxendale and Evans. And what they suggest is that during the boom, there's a change in entrepreneurial quality. If we think about what entrepreneurs are supposed to do, in the Austrian view, especially in the Misesian view, what entrepreneurs really do in the economy is they foresee things. They're very good at foreseeing what demand for a product is going to look like in the future. That way I know, as an entrepreneur, what types of things I should invest in to actually end up making a profit. So I'm very good at foresight. And what Baxendale and Evans suggest is that during the boom, right, booms attract, in effect, lousy entrepreneurs. Lousy is a technical term. Yeah, it's spelled something like my horrible handwriting there. Okay. Right. This boom will attract lousy entrepreneurs. Or more or less what's going on as the boom proceeds, we could imagine, kind of get nervous drawing continuum, but here's a continuum. Right. And on the one hand, we have some entrepreneurs that are very good. We'll say they're high-skilled entrepreneurs. These are people with excellent foresight. Right. Maybe they have excellent foresight because they understand Austrian economics and are much better at applying it than I am. Or maybe they just have a good sense, a good intuition for what markets are going to do. So you have these skilled entrepreneurs on the one end. On the other end, we have, I guess we could call them foolish or lousy entrepreneurs who really don't have a good sense of foresight. And I suggest what happens during the boom, I'm borrowing very much from Baxendale and Evans here, is that in normal times, funds tend to go to a set of people that tend to be relatively skilled entrepreneurs. Right? But in effect, that's what capital markets are supposed to do. Right? When I'm investing my money in various companies, right, I'm going to invest in those companies that I think are run by people that can actually do their job well. Right? And on average, I'm actually going to be reasonably good at picking the right people. Banks are going to do the same thing when they're lending money. I want to invest in somebody who's actually going to succeed, right, and therefore be able to pay back this loan. Right. So when we have normal times, we end up with very skilled entrepreneurs that are very good at foresight, and the economy tends to zoom along relatively well. We get good economic growth, we don't have huge disruptions. What happens during the boom, I'd suggest, is that two things happen at the same time. With the boom, on the one hand, we have credit expansion. Credit expansion expands, appropriately enough, the set of entrepreneurs right, so now we're going to end up with more entrepreneurs being funded than before. As we're creating new money, putting it into credit markets, that means now we can actually fund more projects. Well, the reality is that we've already funded the best projects. So let's see if I can get both these on there at the same time. No, can't. So we've already funded the best projects here in this set. Now we need to find new projects to fund. These new projects must, so those are skilled, there are lousy. These new projects must, by necessity, have a lesser chance of success than those that we've already funded. Or at least, in expectation, have a lesser chance of success. And I'd suggest at the same time, there's something else going on during the boom. And that is that as it progresses, the skilled entrepreneurs get out. Right, those that are actually reasonably good about foresight, sure, it might be early on in the bubble, they hang on for a bit because there are profits to be made, but as we get closer and closer to the crisis point, they start jumping ship. Right. So what that does is make the whole process even worse, right, because we still have this money flowing into credit markets that's going to go to fund somebody. Right. All of the best entrepreneurs are getting out. Right. So now we're funding people that are all systematically worse than we would fund during normal times. In effect, what I'm arguing here is that during the boom, right, it's not so much that entrepreneurs get fooled by the boom process. Rather, it's that the boom attracts all kinds of fools to become entrepreneurs, right, and in fact empowers them to become entrepreneurs, where normally they wouldn't be able to get funding they can during the boom. And here I might point to something like just anecdotally. Peter Schiff, if you read some of his works, you find out during the housing boom, he very much avoided buying a house. He decided to live in his apartment. His apartment was far cheaper than the house across the street would have been. And he knew the housing boom was going to have to collapse. So what's going on? We have a very skilled entrepreneur that has hopped out of the market, right? Opening up for a much more foolish entrepreneur to hop in. All right. It's more or less what I'm claiming is that the reason we end up with these errors, at least in part, is because we have a systematic change in the skill of our entrepreneurs. Not that entrepreneurs become less skilled, but because less skilled people become entrepreneurs. It's a different set of people. All right, so that's errors. Now let's hop on to talk a little bit about capital. Like here, and we've already heard a lot about capital from Dr. Garrison. Try to speak very briefly then about this point. The point that Austrians would make about capital is that really the Austrian business cycle is really about a distorted capital structure. I could draw some triangles here, but you've already seen that. So I'll take a little different approach. Once again, because I get nervous anytime I start graphing things, just because it's very easy to forget what's actually going on underneath this. And so just to kind of tell the story, what we mean is say that I have a very simple productive process. I'm trying to get water from point A to point B. And there are a number of ways that I could do this. Right? I could do it a relatively simple way is just to get some buckets, right, and go and pull it out of the lake, carry it to my house, right, dump it in a swimming pool or whatever, right, wherever I want the water to be. And this would be a very straightforward way to do it. It's not a roundabout production process at all. Right? Now, another option that might actually be better in the long run is to take the time, take the effort to actually establish a pipeline between the source of the water and where I want the water to end up. This takes some time to do, right? It takes quite a bit of investment to get there. Right, so more or less what the Austrian theory suggests is that these low interest rates lead people to do things like starting to build these pipelines. But then before we can complete them, right, the incentives change. Right? So say interest rates rise, so now I can no longer afford to finish the pipeline and I have to go back to using buckets. Right, so we end up with this huge waste of both time and also resources as I'm investing in this pipeline that doesn't quite get completed. Okay. I could do that with triangles, but you can do it with buckets and imagination as well. All right. So more or less what's happening is that we have artificially low interest rates leading entrepreneurs into these nice long production processes. It'll be nice once we complete them, but it ends up we won't be able to complete them. We can't keep interest rates low forever. Or another way we can put that is that when we push down interest rates, it creates incentives. Part of the reason that this is unsustainable is that I'm trying to invest resources while at the same time as I still have every reason to go ahead and consume those resources. And that's part of the point that Professor Garrison makes with his production possibility frontier. We're trying to push beyond the resources we have. Right? Just as a side note here, this suggests that if you read Paul Krugman's critique of the Austrian business cycle theory, he clearly doesn't have a clue about it. As he suggests that the Austrian business cycle theory suggests that investment and consumption should move in opposite directions all the time. And that's not at all true. If you just, even if you only have a modicum of understanding of what Professor Garrison's trying to graph, you can see, yes, we have more investment and more consumption at the same time. Right? That is actually part of the story. So as soon as I hit that mistake with Krugman's critique, you just kind of throw it out and say, he's arguing against something, but it's not what the Austrian theory says. Okay, so we can toss that out. Okay. So the story actually is artificially low interest rates lead us to make these errors in producing things through this long process, this capital-intensive process that isn't going to work out. Okay. All right. Now, another analogy that I like to use here is to think of lead baseball factories. So instead of thinking about interest rates and distortions in the capital structure regarding time, we could think of something very simple. Say the government says, well, we think we aren't producing enough lead baseballs. For whatever reason, they believe this is true. So we're going to start subsidizing the production of lead baseballs. Right, so the government has decided they're going to go out and buy a bunch of lead baseballs to really encourage production in this area that just isn't getting enough investment. Well, the problem is that eventually the government runs into funding problems. They have to defund these subsidies. All right, so then we end up with these empty lead baseball factories. And that's more or less what the Austrian story is suggesting, is that because of low interest rates, we're making investments that aren't going to work out. They're not going to make sense once interest rates rise. Okay. All right. So, having established these two things, we talk about errors, talk about the business cycle, how do we fit this together and somehow touch it into government stimulus? Okay. Well, I would suggest, like, whenever you go through a crisis, and I notice this as you listen to politicians in the most recent crisis, the government always talks about we want to create jobs. We want to create jobs because creating jobs is a good thing. I'm immediately suspicious of this. Because I personally would be very happy if I didn't have a job but still had an income. Right? That'd be great. Right? I just got this check in the mail every month, and I could do whatever I wanted. Right. The job is not what I care about. I care about the income. But anyway, governments want to create jobs. Okay. Because this is a good thing for some reason. And would like to use some kind of stimulus spending to do it. Right. So the government's going to go out and fund a bunch of projects. Typically, what we heard at least this time, was we want to have projects that have an immediate impact. These are shovel-ready projects. We've already done all the planning. Things are set up so we can really just hit the ground running. But then we need to think, what types of projects are going to be shovel-ready when we hit just after the crisis? Right. Let's think about the lead baseball factory again. Right. So we funded this lead baseball factory. It got built. We were producing nice lead baseballs. We defunded the thing, and now we have this empty lead baseball factory. Right. We want to have some kind of investment we can make, something that the government can buy, right, that's really going to lead to lots of production really fast. Well, if we look around, we'll notice we have a bunch of empty lead baseball factories. Let's just buy lead baseballs. That's exactly the wrong thing to do if what we care about is actually using our resources to produce something that somebody would actually want. The whole reason that these businesses are in crisis is that they're producing something that, in the end, consumers weren't willing to pay for at a profitable price. So having the government cover that up is exactly the wrong thing to do because we want to move resources out of these industries and into ones that actually produce something that some consumer is going to want. Okay. And so which projects are shovel-ready? It's those lead baseball factories sitting there empty. All we have to do is hire the people, put them in the factory, and we can start producing more lead baseballs. Right. Now, here, an important point is that, and we say, okay, we want to create jobs and all this, but really, to a certain degree, this has to be a lie. Just because you do some of the basic math. Right? I'm not asking too much, no calculus here, just some division. And you listen to the numbers that politicians give you. They say, okay, right, we have this $800 billion stimulus package. We think it's going to create 4 million jobs. Right. Okay, $800 billion divided by 4 million, how much does each of those jobs cost us? Right. Well, it's $200,000 per job. Right. I would like one of those jobs. Right. Right. Until we realize they don't actually make those $200,000 it's costing. Right. Right. Somewhere, a lot of this money is just vanishing. Right. Well, what's happening? Well, it ends up, if you want to employ somebody and have them actually do something that looks somewhat productive, you have to buy other things as well as their labor. Right? So if you want to put them in this lead baseball factory, we have to make sure the lights are running so we can actually use the machinery that's there. We have to make sure the machinery is in good condition. That's another expense. We have to make sure we have the lead, which isn't horribly expensive, but will cost something. Right? So a lot of resources are going into creating all these complementary factors to go along with these people that we're going to hire. Okay. Right, so just to further drive home that point, we're taking resources, real resources, and misdirecting them toward exactly those things that really we should stop doing. Right? I would suggest that a better thing for us to do, if we're going to go ahead and spend $800 billion on creating jobs, why not just send $50,000 checks to 16 million people that were unemployed at the time? Right? Tell them to watch TV 40 hours a week, write a report. Yeah, that's a job. It's actually not a bad job, I'd imagine. Okay, I guess it depends what TV you have to watch. A lot of it you may not want to. Okay, right, but this is going to create four times as many jobs as the plan that they made, right? And yet somehow we don't consider it, right? Okay, well, why is that? Well, I think on the face of it, we recognize this paying people to watch television for a year. We know that's unproductive. That is, on the face of it, an unproductive thing to do. Right? And I think even politicians recognize that the purpose of our work is to produce something. Now, they seem to forget the word valuable should follow that. Right? We want to produce something valuable, ideally, but if we can't do that, let's just produce something. Right? And so then we create these jobs. We're producing something like lead baseballs. We try to do better than that. We're going to fix roads and bridges and the like, things that look more valuable than these lead baseballs are. But that doesn't mean we can justify the expense of it. Right? So we end up having to use a lot of the stimulus spending not to actually create jobs, because that's not totally the purpose. Right? We want to create jobs that look acceptable, right? That look like they're doing something valuable. So really, in the end, the point that I want to make is that effective stimulus, that is the stimulus that will increase production, will end up increasing employment as much as possible, but at the same time trying to end up with some kind of tangible product. To get that tangible product, we have to take these resources that we should be redirecting somewhere else because they were misused during the boom. We should be, if we want to produce something that looks tangible, we're going to end up directing it toward what it was doing before, right? This erroneous activity. Okay. But in reality, I think the cheapest way, if we really want to create jobs that are valuable, right, is to take all of these malinvestments, get rid of them, right, very quickly find a way, because it ends up that virtually anything can be used for more than one thing. Some things are more valuable than others. Right? So sure, it's true, building this lead baseball factory was a mistake. It might take some money and some resources to rework it to actually make something else there. So, okay, we have to use what we have, but at the same time, we have to use it for something that people will actually value and be willing to pay for. But that's something we can leave to the market. Entrepreneurs are out there seeking profit all the time. Right? You give them resources that, because they were malinvested, now very cheap. What happened to the price of housing? Okay. It collapsed by something like, what is that, 30% from here to here? It became much, much cheaper. Right? Let entrepreneurs figure out what it is people want and that we can use these resources to make. Okay. It ends up governments are horribly bad at this. They don't face the incentives. They're just trying to create jobs in a way that looks, creates the illusion of productivity. So that's quite simply the point that I wanted to make. I'm leaving now. Substantial time for some Q&A. I'm happy to talk about this. Or anything else you want to talk about, I'm fine with that. Yeah.
I appreciate your abstinence from using graphics.
Sure.
Did Rothbard kind of point or already say your second argument about the lousy investors coming in when you talked about the get rich schemes? Do you think it's leverage?
Yeah, it's a good question. In case you didn't hear, the question is, did Rothbard already hint at this by talking about things like get rich quick schemes becoming very attractive during the boom and the like? I think certainly that would hint at the same idea, right? That these things are sold to people that really don't necessarily have the entrepreneurial ability to see how things are going to turn out. Absolutely. Yeah, so I don't claim it's original to me, or even necessarily to Baxendale and Evans, for that matter. I think it's just bringing in the insight that the set of entrepreneurs does change over the course of the boom. Right? You're drawing in people like me that aren't good entrepreneurs. Right? Okay. Yeah, sure. What do you mean?
Because my view is that foresight is that people can't foresee much in the future, that the entrepreneurs that are more successful during the boom or during the boom and bust cycle are those who can adapt more to the current situation than those who can foresee what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to see what are your thoughts on that.
Okay. So yeah, the question is entrepreneurial success more a matter of foresight or perhaps adaptability? I guess I feel like the two would go hand in hand. Right? Because on the one hand, being adaptable in itself only helps if I know how to adapt. And that requires some degree of foresight. Now, how detailed that foresight is, I guess in a sense there's a trade-off here, in that if you somehow manage to have some kind of production process that's extremely adaptable, right? Where, I don't know, you're creating this lobby stuff that can be formed into lots of different things last minute, say? Because you don't quite know what's going to be produced, what people are actually going to want. Okay, so I guess you could go about that path. But at the same time, I'd suggest that on average, it's going to be more productive to choose a more specific path. Right. But there you lose flexibility, but that would require more foresight to end up being successful. So I think foresight will play a role. How much of a role? Yeah, I think there's a trade-off there to some degree. I guess, and there's also a foresight component in how adaptable you have to be. Right? If, in fact, we have a very predictable economy, right, then adaptability won't gain me anything. It's only in times where things are very unpredictable or difficult to foresee that I need to be more adaptable. So how adaptable you choose to be is also a matter of, I guess, entrepreneurial foresight. Right? How tough is the economy going to be when it comes down to it? Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd suggest that some people do never learn. That's exactly it. Right. All we really need are enough entrepreneurs that don't learn, either because it might be, I guess one thing point that we face is that people aren't infinitely long-lived. Right. So when you come out as an entrepreneur that's very young, you only have so much experience. And studying history can help. I don't know that it's quite the same as living through things, maybe. It's just a guess. So on the one hand, we have new people coming in that don't necessarily have the experience, haven't had time to learn. And those that have the experience are starting to die off. And then you have the fact that some people just have a difficult time learning. And those are going to be the ones that are most likely to be fooled in to the boom in the first place. As long as we have enough of those people, right, to buy in and keep the boom going for a little while, we can still end up with it. Yeah. Oh yes. Here, the point was just that even if you know the theory doesn't tell you what the right interest rate is, and that does make it very difficult, even for somebody who's well informed. At the same time, Austrian business cycle theory tends to suggest that our bubbles show up in very specific locations in the economy. Which of those specific locations at any point in time, theory doesn't tell us. Right? Is it going to be in housing this time? Is it going to be in internet stocks? Is it going to be in automotives? We don't know. Right? So it's very difficult to tell, okay, are things going up because we just need more houses for people? So the demand went up. Or is it, in fact, a boom going on here that's going to collapse? It's not obvious. Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Can you explain why they think that?
Okay. Hey, I hear the question is, there are some Austrians that would say real business cycle theory, I guess, helps us better understand the Austrian business cycle theory. Why that is, I don't know, honestly. I'm kind of in an odd position in that myself, I am actually somewhat sympathetic to the real business cycle theory view. In that I would say not all economic fluctuations are Austrian business cycles. Right? Austrian business cycle is a very precise type of fluctuation that tends to explain the really big booms and busts that we get. While the small things, okay, maybe there are these random things going on, productivity changes and the like, that the real business cycle folks would say. Right, yeah, these types of things. So I guess for me it wouldn't necessarily help me better understand the Austrian business cycle theory as to better understand economic fluctuations on the whole. And there are some that are Austrian business cycles, there are some that are not. Right? So that'd be my answer from my perspective. I can't speak for these others. Right. Yeah, so Okay, here the question is, right, is it possible that, in effect, economic calculation stops being possible, in effect, that you just can't calculate profit and loss in some of these situations? I'd say during the standard business cycle, probably not. As long as we have a well-established price system, right, I can calculate here what my costs were, here are my revenues. At the same time, it's possible for the price system to get extremely distorted, say if we have extremely high rates of price inflation, something like that. If prices are really changing a lot, that's really going to lead to a miscalculation of profits, but not make it impossible as long as we have those prices. So I would tend to say not in most cases, unless we go through full monetary meltdown and the money stops being useful as money. Yeah. Yes? Okay. And so the question is more or less, what is it that sparks the realization that we've made the error, more or less? Okay. I don't know. I always see it too late myself. right. But what types of things can happen? It could be, a lot of the time it's a change in interest rates, right, where we've gotten to the point where we were keeping interest rates really low. People kind of expected them to stay that way. It's hard to explain things like adjustable rate mortgages without saying people expected interest rates to stay low. Once they rise and it becomes clear they're going to stay high for a little bit, it's a change in information of what we're observing that then proves that we had to have been wrong. So I tend to say it has that kind of category, right? There's something I was looking to happen in the future. I'm now living in the future and it's not true anymore. Right? And it's not true in a significant enough way that I've changed my mind about the investment that I've made. Right? So specifically what that would be, high interest rates is one. Right? It could be lots of things though. I'd also say when you get toward the later end as the collapse is happening, I might have had expectations about what the price of housing is going to be when I bought a house, speculating in it. Okay, housing prices are falling. I'm clearly not right about that, so I'm going to change my mind. So I'd say, in general, I had an expectation that wasn't fulfilled. In some obvious way, that changes my mind about what I'm going to do. Yeah?
I tend to think that the back nail Evans story probably fits best, but I'm also... large financial institutions.
Sure.
If you're setting up a strategy of how to go at it, you see that it is a bubble.
Sure.
If you don't make the profit that all your competitors are making, your shareholders are going to replace you. So at that point, it seems like it would almost be better for you to ride it out even if you crash.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think that's more or less the Curley-Dempster story. Is that what seems to matter in their argument is that relative profits matter. Right. So it's important during the boom that I'm making just as much profit as anybody else. During the bust, it's not that big a deal because I'm making just as little profit as everybody else, or just as significant losses, as long as I'm following the herd. I have some problems with that, and that really that just moves the point of the error back a step, right? And that it's, okay, now it's not the people running the financial institutions, say, but it's people investing in them that's making the error. Right? So why are we all investing in these businesses that are making these types of errors? Right? And now it might be that, say, as stock market investors were extremely short-sighted, well, that's really just a particular type of error, right? To value present profits, forgetting about future profits. Or I might be making the error and thinking, yes, this is something that we can actually somehow manage to avoid. That's also an error. So I think it just moves it back a step in terms of the error we have to explain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
From what little I know and what little is rational, the effort that is rational for me to put into that process.
Yeah. Sure.
This is the view that I have, and it's based on, you know, how my portfolio is doing compared to the market.
And there is this category of investor that very much will follow the herd. Right. And it could be like an information thing where if the stock price is going up, it must be for a reason. I don't know what that is, but I'm going to go ahead and buy anyway. Right. It could be something like that. But I don't really know if that removes the error question per se. If anything, to me, that feels much more like the Baxendale story. And then we have this type of investor that systematically makes these types of errors, rather than actually trying to figure out what investments are going to do well, just follow the herd, which is not a good strategy on the whole. So, yeah, I think once we move it back a step, we get back to Baxendale and Evans, and who are these people funding these institutions? That's my thought on that right now. Probably think more about it. Yes, sir.
You said that entrepreneur quality increases. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say it's a combination, right? So to repeat the question, right? So why is it the skilled entrepreneurs are in effect sitting out? Right? Why did they get pushed out of the market? Could it be that they see the bubble is going to pop, or could it just be that they just don't like the interest rate they're receiving? Yes, there we go. Yeah, it's either certainly possible. To me, it's more believable that early in the boom, the low interest rate's the more believable story. Later in the boom, the fact that the collapse is coming at some point, relatively soon, seems like the more believable story at that point. Especially since we tend to see interest rates be somewhat higher as we get toward the later stages of the boom. Yeah. So you want to wait for things to collapse, hop in later. Right. Yeah. Do the famous Mr. Potter type of strategy. From It's a Wonderful Life. Pay pennies on the dollar to everyone when they're panicking. That's a reasonable strategy. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Tom Woods made a point where when you increase credit, you're also bringing in the marginally worse investments, including borrowers. So say you have lenders and borrowers or investors and investments. Marginally worse ones would you simply not have invested in? Or just like kind of on, again, the margin of
Right. Yeah, that's the point that Tom Woods brings up. Yeah, I think it's pretty good. Right. And actually, we can think about that along. It's very similar to the Baxendale story. Right. That if instead of thinking about entrepreneurs getting funded, we have investments that get funded. Right. Have more funding, you end up with marginally worse. Marginally worse investments getting funded because there's more funding there during the credit expansion. Sure, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Huh. So then we could think along two different dimensions. Right? We're not just funding lousier entrepreneurs, but even the good entrepreneurs have lousier investments to fund. Right? So, yeah, I like that. That's good. Others, yeah. I think here, there are two important points in that comment. Right, one being there is kind of this, I guess what we typically call an agency problem, Where if I'm a financial manager, I'm not investing my own money. I'm investing somebody else's money. Right? If I lose it, well, it wasn't mine to start with. Right? Now, on the one hand, that's true. On the other hand, I suggest that that is kind of an institutional problem. But we need to make sure that the manager's incentives line up with the investor's incentives in some way. Right? We don't always do that well. That's certainly true. And then what was the second point you made that I liked? Say that again. Oh, the average people. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that that fits very well. This observation that the average people seem to always hop in somewhere close to the end of when the boom is going on. Yeah, I think that fits very well with this Baxendale story. That, okay, things are going well. And then finally, people that don't watch financial markets normally notice that things are going well. And so they start hopping in. Despite their lack of knowledge, oh, I know that things are going up very well. We all know housing never falls. I mean, after all, look, right? Housing prices never fall. Right? Right. Okay, you get the point. It's something that we know is blatantly untrue. Right? You go back to the early 90s and housing prices fell, not as much as they did recently, but they did fall. Right? But if you're only paying attention to what's been happening recently, it's very easy to believe what some people might be saying in financial news, that normal housing appreciation is 10% a year. It's not at all true over the long term, but over a set of 4 or 5 years that immediately preceded, it feels true. So yeah, it's certainly true. And the average person doesn't necessarily know. We're not professional investors. Most average people aren't. So they don't necessarily know how to process the information. So, okay, I'm going to believe what the expert tells me. And they very well could be wrong, they very well could be lying, depending on the case. Yeah? Right. Yeah, the interesting thing to me about this, right, so Ben Bernanke appears before Congress on a pretty regular basis or just before the media and says, no, we are going to keep rates low. We're going to keep rates low. And despite that, we're seeing long-term interest rates rise, right? Which suggests that we all understand that in our system, there's really nothing that can hold Bernanke to that. He very well could just change his mind, right? Wake up one morning and say, nah, today's the day. Right? I don't think that's likely, right? Just to make that clear. I don't think it's likely that he's just going to change his mind like that, but it is possible. And I think that what's happening is the markets are recognizing that the pressures he's going to come under are going to push him in that direction. Right? That while it's true that we've not seen enormous increases in prices, it seems like the market believes they're coming. Right? And also believes that Ben Bernanke won't be able to ignore that even if, say, unemployment stays relatively high. Right, so I guess we do have that problem. But while it is true that central bankers do try to, I think they use the term anchor expectations. Right? We want to try to anchor expectations so that people do actually believe we're going to do this set of things. We also understand that they very well could be lying to us and could change their mind. There's nothing to keep them from doing that. So it might be erroneous to listen to them. Possibly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it is certainly possible that say, yeah, after the bust happens, there are people that are just so scared of the market. They just say, no, I'm not going to invest at all. Like you said, I'll just invest in a career, in earning a wage. That's certainly true. Actually, in my money and banking class, just until last semester, had them go and pick stocks at the beginning of the semester and watch how they did. And I managed to convince, I believe, the majority of my students that they shouldn't pick stocks. Which may be a good thing, right? I guess great entrepreneurs are not more than half of us, almost certainly. But I think there is that reality, right? Which is actually could also feed into some of the entrepreneurs that hang on the longest are those that are most overconfident in their own abilities. That is something that can happen. Okay, I think we might have time for one more question. Yes?
You're talking about the entrepreneurs on the investment side. Mm-hmm. Are any of the entrepreneurs in this space
Sure. Right, yeah. So, there's this big question of how do you exit when, as an entrepreneur, what you're actually doing is running a business, right? Like you said, the construction companies and the like. Now, one option that is possible, but not always easy, is to sell your business to someone else. Say, okay, I'm going to get out of housing. I have this established business with a name. I'll sell it off to somebody. So that is a possibility. It doesn't require that you totally shut down and destroy the business. You can sell it to somebody else. And I think that is something we might see, say, in housing. Right? If I believe there's a housing bubble, I don't burn my house down. Right? I sell it off to somebody else who's willing to buy it from me. Right? And so I think that's the way we tend to see that happen. And it also suggests a reason that it's very difficult to get this type of bubble under control. And that there's no possibility to short such a thing. Right? I can sell a business I have, but I can't sell one that I don't have like I can with a stock. Right? So on the productive side, it's very difficult to control that bubble on the short side of things. All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.